Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between.
We've partnered with the Brain Tumour Charity, a cause that means a great deal to me personally. And thanks to our partnership, we've been able to create a short series of special podcasts uncovering those within the motorsport community who've been affected by these devastating diagnoses. You can hear my story as well as the Williams Formula One team's planning director Richard Jones now, with more to come. Also, if you feel like getting involved further, the Brain Tumour Charity is running the Conquer the Challenge through till May, a virtual fundraiser for those fitness inclined, and there's a leaderboard, so if you're competitive, this is for you. All the details are at braintumourcharity.org. Together, we can help every single person affected by a brain tumour. Now, as you know, without you and our sponsors, we wouldn't be able to carry on doing what we do, which is bringing you the biggest names in motorsport and delving into their lives and opinions. This season, we couldn't be happier to be teaming up with F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula One. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the pinnacle of motorsport. And let's face it, any chance to get close to Formula One this year, we're all over it. With F1 Experiences official ticket packages coming direct from Formula One, you can get unique access that simply isn't available anywhere else. For more information on how you can book your F1 experience, visit f1experiences.com, where you can also save 5% on your very own F1 Experiences package by using the code MOTORMOUTH when checking out online. Good things come to those who listen to the Motormouth podcast. Don't say we don't treat you well. So what are you waiting for? The 2021 F1 season is set to be one of the closest in years, so get booking your F1 experience today with F1experiences.com.
Hello, Tim Sylvie here. Now, today we're joined by a man who has established himself as a global endurance racing star and has started following in the footsteps of his father with more than a touch of broadcasting know-how. He hails from the lovely British county of Norfolk, much like another of our recent podcast guests, Jake Humphrey. And did you know that our guest's hometown of King's Lynn unearthed from its town centre the bones of an 800-year-old cod which measured 51 inches long, a veritable monster by today's COD standards, which measure a mere 18 inches. What do you make of that, Harry Benjamin?
Wow, you learn something new every day. I've just spent 3 years of my life in Norfolk, having graduated from university there. So, and I didn't know that my entire time. So I'll be intrigued to see if our guest knows that as well. I imagine they probably do. Apart from learning about interesting Norfolk facts, I am fed up with my hair. Look at it. It's getting ridiculous.
Yeah, it's massive.
Actually, it's out of control.
It's not just big. It's not just big up there, like on top. It's
everywhere.
You have a full-on afro.
Yeah. And I've never learned to get this long before. And in lockdown one, I shaved it all off. I went bald. I had a Britney moment.
Do you know what? It's funny because when you listen to podcasts and you kind of build up an image, don't you, of what the presenters look like? Like before I followed Guy Raz on Instagram, I listened to him on his podcast. He's got loads, but he's really good. And I built up this picture of him in my head, and he's nothing like what I imagined he is in real life. I wonder when people listen to you, whether they realise that they're listening to a guy that's got hair that's about the same height as his body. Do you remember, what was that guy, that rapper? Was it Ice Baby? Who was that guy?
Eminem?
No, Ice Ice Baby. And he had this like block on top of his head of hair. That's what you remind me of. So if anyone doesn't know how he looks like, he basically looks like that with really dark hair.
You've never ever gone specific. This is the weirdest intro we've ever done.
Yeah. Anyway.
Let us know. What do you think I look like? Let us know.
Shall I introduce our guest?
I think we better. We've been rambling for far too long.
So today we're joined by a man who's found his way to the top of endurance racing via karts, T-cars, Formula Palmer Audi, that's a mouthful, F3, F2, and of course sports cars, even racing alongside his rather illustrious father at Le Mans. Talking of his father, Alex has started to follow in not only his racing boots, but his broadcasting shoes as well, with appearances alongside the highly rated Alex Jakes to commentate on F2, F3, and F1 TV. It's our pleasure to have him here. Alex Brundle, welcome to the Motormouth Podcast.
Hello, both. Thanks for having me on. It's been interesting to hear your opening. I'll have to borrow some of those lines. There's actually a metal statue of that cod in the town square. No, there's not. You're right. I was thinking Marge Simpson, actually.
Yes.
Oh, brilliant.
That's pretty good.
Well, it's good to be on. Thanks so much for chatting to me.
No, it's a pleasure, Alex. Thanks for coming on. If there isn't a metal statue there, well, I think that needs to happen, whatever. I think they did build, wasn't there an Alan Partridge one in Norwich? They built an Alan Partridge statue recently, I think, in the last year or something like that. But
There definitely should be.
Anyway, aside from Norwich,
it's actually Norfolk's biggest export.
Yeah. It actually is, isn't it? Yeah, it really is. I mean, you think he's made them a lot of money. Apart from that, the Brundles have done pretty well for it. How have you been getting on this last year? Your haircut's looking pretty trim, I must say.
This is a mum special. I'm very comfortable to admit that. But my mother is actually, and she learned from YouTube like a millennial would. Which was pretty cool as well. So she learned from YouTube, and then she's one of those people that can learn something and she'll just do it. I hate those people.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the people that can, you know, learn something and it doesn't take them any practice whatsoever. They can just then immediately do it. Yeah. And she learned to cut hair.
Chloe, my wife, cut my hair a couple of weeks ago, which she's done pretty well. But it's just that you get the odd stray, don't you? Like I've got a little bit here on the side, which is just longer than everything else, but to be honest, I think she's done all right. Harry, just get one of your family members to cut your hair.
Oh, I don't trust anybody. And after the Britney moment last year, I'd rather hold out. 12th of April, I think, isn't that when it's all okay? I'm gonna hold out hope and hopefully that'll be right. But anyway, hair done. Alex, you career go.
Yes.
let's start. From the very, very beginning, of course, take us back to when you were very young. Because actually, even though obviously your dad is Martin Brundle, for those who haven't put two and two together yet, he'd left Formula One by the time, I mean, you were really young still. So actually, did that have much of an influence? Do you remember growing up much with that in mind?
No. So Formula One, I missed a lot of because he finished up F1 in 1995. And, you know, he did a bit of kind of testing stuff after that. But what I mostly remember of his racing is sports car racing, actually. The first racing that I went to of his where I was sort of old enough to be sentient is the Toyota Le Mans program. And I distinctly remember being there at Le Mans and enjoying it. And so maybe that's how I've ended up in a sports car myself.
Yeah. Did you ever when we were chatting about Harry and I off air about your life and your father's career and so on, when you were little, do you remember, like, I have this kind of romantic vision of the door swinging open in your house and in walks Hill, and then Johnny Herbert comes over for a cup of tea, and, you know, Blundell's there. Was it just a conveyor belt of amazing Formula One legends?
I mean, if our house was situated perhaps, you know, in Silverstone Valley, then it might have been. But where we are in Norfolk, there's actually no journey in the UK where you would travel through.
Yeah,
where I live. So we're very much at the sticks, and it's I'm not now. Mostly I'm in London, just because of being a young person and having to see occasionally other people, and wanting to be connected to airports and so on and so forth. But my mother and father have chosen to live in Norfolk just because they love it, just because they love the people, just because we love the people and the environment here. And but yeah, I mean, there were some amazing people who came through this place. I remember Colin McRae dropping in once with a great big model of a 555 Subaru, you know, and just plunking it down on the desk in casually. The office and hanging out here. And yeah, just, you know, whenever anybody was doing anything at Snetterton, they'd drop by and stay and that kind of thing. And it's something which you only really appreciate fully much, much later on, yeah, such as the misfortune of being a young person in that environment. But the fortune that you get to be, but the misfortune that you don't really understand the relevance of it all until much later on, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. When you were first starting, though, and then you started to like all racing drivers, you tend to start off in karts. How was that experience? You know, were you racing against anybody we might know now? And how were you... Was your family a bit worried about you going into racing, or were they quite, you know, encouraging of it?
So my dueling partners in karting were Tom Ingram from British Touring Cars. Yeah. I had some, a lot of races with Jack Gough as well from British Touring Cars. Who else was going around at the time? Ollie Rowland was bouncing around at the time as well. You know, honestly, I didn't do a lot of karting, and it sounds really weird, but, you know, the contract between us, I mean, I went all the way through university education. I have a degree now. So I basically was, the education for me was enforced all the way through. Even, you know, I was doing my degree while I raced in Formula 2. So where I would do sort of, say, 15 race meetings a year, you know, there would be drivers out there doing 40, but, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way. I had a massive opportunity then when I moved into cars to sort of, and with a lot more experience. Like, we didn't really understand karting. Dad never did it. He, you know, he was a nutter in a stock car when he was 12, and just didn't do, he just refused to participate in the traditional route. I mean, the story of Dad's career is really something quite special, from kind of driving a car basically stole off his dad's forecourt around a dirt track in, you know, in Pot Row, which is just down the way from our place in Norfolk, to you know, to being in Formula One. And so actually the traditional route for him was something he found quite confusing, because his experience was just nothing like that of, you know, say somebody like a John Alesi or a Gerhard Berger, who set out to become race car drivers and succeeded, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of it's generational, because we had Mark Blundell on last year at some stage, and he was similar to your dad. You know, he basically nicked Ferraris from the forecourt of his old man's, you know, place, and just tore around a field or took it around the roads, and that was his introduction to racing. And he actually started on motorbikes, I think. So yeah. It's a varied way that people get into the sport. I mean, today it's very different, isn't it? Young karters, they start at like 6 years old and are spending 100 grand a year before they're 10, and, you know, it just goes on from there. You did go into T-cars, though, which I'm gutted is not around in this day and age. Someone needs to reinvent or rebrand T-cars and bring it back. Just explain what that is for people that aren't aware of it and what happened to it.
They were great. They were like it's like a silhouette. I would describe it as a silhouette. So it's a tubular chassis with the bodywork pinned on top. And they had a 2-litre Mountune Ford engine in the front and 5-speed gearbox. You put it into fifth, it went slower, but they were awesome. They had a rear wing, which actually worked, and a little splitter on the front. And if you lost the splitter, that was obviously doing something as well because it understeered horrendously. Four tyres, which were basically the Formula Ford compound and specification, about 900 kilos. And they were such great cars. They really were. So the options at the time were that or a Ginetta or a Clio Cup car. And I didn't want to go down the route of a Clio Cup because front wheel drive was not kind of where I was going. And Ginetta, we just didn't really have the context. And Jonathan Palmer was going to go that way and going to, you know, bring Jolyon Palmer through that. And we kind of, you know, held on to the shirt tails and went in that direction. It was a great year. Yeah. A couple of years racing, actually.
So cool. Honestly, I think we should agree now that we club together, we start T-cars again. I mean, like British touring cars is feels like it's always been there. It's always been big. And I don't know whether it's just me, but I've become a lot more aware of it in the last few years. I don't know whether that's just situational or whatever. But people love British touring cars. And there's no sort of natural, outside of sort of Ginettas and stuff like that, there's no natural touring car progression like there is with F2 and F3. Let's bring it back. Let's make it happen.
There's no road to touring cars, is there? No. It's all road to F1. But
you can go and do Clio Cup but you're right. There's no sort of hard and fast way to get into a touring car. I mean, but drivers come from all directions. I mean, you've got guys like Rob Collard who would come through from, you know, stock cars and that kind of thing. And then, you know, Andy Jordan, who went and did a little rally cross and came back. All the way through to Jason Plato, who basically got there by camping outside Renault until they gave him a drive back in the 90s. So it's a cool environment. But yeah, definitely not the way that I was going. I have actually tested a British touring car, only for one day around Snap.
Well, what was that, recently or was that a while ago?
No. I tested the 888 Vectra. It would have been the year after I did Formula 3 in 2010, a guy called Ian Harrison, who's a bit of a touring car legend, invited me to come and test it. I did okay, actually. I did all right. I was wiggling the steering wheel and playing with the throttle. I'm not sure if I was having any effect on the car, but it stayed between the white lines. So whatever I was doing,
that's positive. You didn't stack it into the wall like you did in the wet at Snetterton. There's that YouTube video of you in one of the T cars, it's wet at Snetterton, and you just end up hitting the wall at pace.
Yeah. So we were on a half wet half. It was a one tire formula. Basically for T cars. And so essentially we have no wet tires per se. So the concept was that it's actually the guy I just miss in the gravel is actually my best mate now. he's, you can see him, Luciano Bichetta eventually became Formula 2 champion a few years later. You can see him getting out of the car, looking over the back of, you know, the rear wing of his T car to see me go flashing by and have a bigger accident the same way. But the tire tread just filled up with water. I went absolutely straight.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of my bigger ones. So I managed to get that camera position nicely as well, didn't
very
I?
Good. Very, very well done. Yeah.
Go and visit that guy in Riches. Yeah.
Well, you survived T-cars, and you did sort of begin to make your way up the single-seat ladder with sort of dipping your toe in Formula 3, or as it was, GP3, GP2. Talk to us about your experiences of that, because obviously it's transformed quite a bit now since you were there, and it's an interesting sort of path. Did you ever feel like you quite clicked with these single-seaters, and did you feel pressure on you almost because of, you know, you're a son of?
Yeah, it was an interesting one. I did click with several series of single seaters. We must be the last generation of drivers who drove a single seater with an H pattern box. Mm. You know, the Formula Palmer Audis had a dog leg HVAC gearbox like an old turbo F1 car would have, which was a great, actually an experience I'm using again now. There are, you know, I'm a late developer in driving terms, just the way I'm built. And certainly I came into my own as I grew older and more experienced through my career. We also always took the view that basically there was no point in just blowing these vast sums of money to eventually gain a career where you would get a bit of it back. But if you've spent, you know, multiple hundreds of thousands, then you eventually get a job driving a sports car for, you know, a few grand a year, then what you've not got is a career. What you've got is a hobby over a long period of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, very expensively. Yeah. So actually, we were always extremely limited on the amount that we were prepared to invest, which put me out of a thing like Formula 3, you know, where really you had to be in a Carlin car to do anything good. In a Formula Palmer Audi, in a Formula 2 car, that excuse wasn't there because all the cars were the same, but I just wasn't really ready to do the job. Until I jumped in a sports car and then just really took off.
Yeah.
To the point where I now race people who, you know, booted me all over the racetrack in a single seater and we're nip and tuck, which is quite a satisfying thing for me, really.
Yeah, and as you say, sports cars is where you really found your niche, or niche, as our American friends will say. And it was 2012 when you made your Le Mans debut in an LMP2 car alongside your old man. So what was it like racing with him? And importantly, who was quickest?
He did a quicker time in practice. I did a quicker average in the race. So it's honours even there to just clear that one out of the way. He was still really fast, but he still is really fast now. I mean, he's like, I always say he's like Yoda. There's a particular scene in the Star Wars movie where Yoda, you know, walks into a room with a stick, you know, kicks everyone's ass and then walks out with a stick. And I always think he's a bit like that. You know what I mean? He kind of hobbles in on his broken ankle, does purple sectors and then leaps. It's incredible. But I mean, as late as 2016, he put a car on pole in a support race at Le Mans. And that's ahead of drivers who then became, you know, young works drivers 2 or 3 years later.
Yeah, amazing.
But that was great. I mean, for me, honestly, I was more focused on the opportunity than I was on driving with him, which sounds like a really strange thing to say. But for him, it was kind of this, you know, experience coming back to Le Mans with your son, strapping him in. For me, it was an opportunity to do Le Mans for the first time. And so that was most of my focus. Like, I was really focused on doing a good job because I had this opportunity with Nissan engines to carry on and move forward, which obviously eventually I did.
First Le Mans experience, though, can you prepare yourself at all? Because it endurance racing and then your previous experience is all, you know, relatively sprint, single seat racing. Is there any way you can prepare for those long stints?
I mean, there's nothing that prepares you for driving a racing car that fast at night. That's the thing which really gets you. And I was blessed in that my first ever Le Mans was dry all the way through. My second Le Mans, rainy, torrential, really, really scary. My first one was dry all the way through. But I remember coming in after my first qualifying attempt. Now, because qualifying a car at Le Mans is brilliant. You have so much regulation freedom, you know, and it really is computer game stuff. You know, you turn up, you put all the engine, you've got everything, you've got the minimum fuel in the car, you put all the engine absolutely everywhere you need it. And all of a sudden this thing just takes off, you know, flash bulbs going from the grandstands. It's proper. You tend to run kind of into dusk or at night is the way that qualifying worked then. It's a little bit different now. And so the first qualifying, because the air's cooler, the first qualifying attempt you do is in the dark. You know, and so you go out there, not only is the car going quicker than it ever has before, but also you're in the blackness. I think Jenson Button said something like, it feels like you're going 3,000 miles an hour. And you just do, you know, how when you're on a country road and it just limits the viewpoint ahead.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it feels like you're going incredibly quickly, even though you're not. Well, times that by 10 and it just feels monstrously quick.
You know, when you're doing that and you're driving at 3,000 miles per hour in the dark, do you, like when I'm driving, I, for a short period about a year, I had a Honda S2000, which is probably the most fun, one of the funnest cars I've ever owned. And when I first got in it and I went through the gears and that crazy Honda gearbox, I was like talking to myself. I was like, yeah, you know, getting to a corner and going, oh my God. Do you do that when you're racing? Like, do you chat to yourself when you're going at those breakneck speeds?
Actively try not to, because in the moment where you finish up having a discussion with yourself, you've already missed the next thing you need to be doing.
Yeah.
And so actually quite a lot of my journey and sort of, I would say, improvement from being a young driver in single seaters, not getting the results always that I wanted and making a lot of mistakes, to being an older driver in sports cars, often getting the results I wanted and making less mistakes, is to silence the mind in many ways and make sure that every time you get in a car, you're really kind of psychologically ready to deliver at your best. Because really there's not a lot between the lot of us in terms of our actual performance. And it's all about getting your mind and body ready to give the best result. I mean, just before we came on, I was looking through the averages of Le Mans last year. And, you know, you're talking, let's say, 10 professional drivers who may well be in a position to ask for a work seat. And they're all between, you know, they're all over an average of the race within 7/10 per lap.
Yeah.
Over a 3.5 minute lap.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just nothing.
Yeah. That was one of the things actually when I was watching the Daytona 24 Hours at the start of the year. And what really, and I've watched endurance racing for a while, but what really got me for some reason of that race was how close it still was between, I think, the top three in the DPI class after, you know, 18 hours or something like that. And I just thought, God, this is better than some F1 races that I've watched. Like, how is that possible? But also, and going back to last year in Le Mans with you, it was so close as well. You were on for the win at some points. You know, the two United cars were properly thrashing it out. And of course, you have all the unpredictability of, you know, longer pit stops and all this kind of thing. Is that what draws you to endurance racing? Is that one of the things that ticks your box? Because it, although it's 24 hours, 6 hours, whatever it may be, it's still so unpredictable somehow.
I like the epicness of it. And that's, you know, that how it's just, the Nürburgring 24 hours is one that's even more kind of gives you even more that sense of kind of adventure or conquest, if you like. You know, you're heading out around this great big track, you know, driving from one town in France to another town in France to another place, or, you know, you're driving from Adenauer out to wherever and back again, you know. And it's just, it gives you this sense of, you know, overcoming the environment in you and the car, kind of overcoming the environment against the competition, which is what I really love about it, which is why it makes me really sad when actually they start to say, that piece of racetrack, it's a little bit difficult because everybody's running a bit wide there. Shall we add a bit of tarmac? Or that piece of curbing, that's a little bit bumpy, that piece of curbing. Should we flatten it off a bit? Yeah. Because it, for me, it should be you and the car against the elements and the circuit. It shouldn't be, you know, you shouldn't be kind of flattening and, you know, and pasting over the bumps. That's the point. The bumps are the point, right? That's what you're overcoming.
They're the challenge.
Totally agree. We used to have that debate really early on when we started this podcast with a few people about track limits and stuff and having a penalty for your errors. You know, that's why things like Monaco are so great. You know, you mess up at Monaco, your race is over. Even if you make a tiny little mistake, you're done. And I think a lot of tracks, some of the runoff areas, I mean, like in Abu Dhabi, I think it's the first left turn one in Abu Dhabi, Yas Marina Circuit. You can go so wide there and you know, drive for, go on a little country outing before you have to rejoin the track again. It's crazy. Let's talk 2013-14. So you had, correct me if I'm wrong, a full season of WEC in 2013 and LMP2 again, and came very close to top spot in the championship. That was a great year for you, but must have been in equal measures frustrating.
Yeah, it was a brutal one. Bertrand Baguette managed to drive the sister car off the grass at the end of the Le Mans 24 hours. So it rained. I mean, Le Mans 24 hours that year was a tragic one. Alan Simonson passed. It was just, you know, the whole Aston Martin team were just, you could just see it in their eyes. Everything about the Le Mans was tough and tricky and difficult. The weather, it was one of those races that has that horrible kind of sensation, that horrible feeling of, you know, do we
dread
really want to be here?
Yeah, exactly.
But then, you know, so in late on in that race, our teammates managed to drive it off the grass and get it across the line for the win. And at that point, Le Mans was a massive proportion of the points of the World Championship. So we couldn't take the win through the year. I finished second twice at the Le Mans 24 hours. That one, I think we could have won. The other one, I was just happy to be on the podium, to be honest, because we'd had such a torrid race. I don't know how we did. It was frustrating. I think more frustrating was that sports cars is so cyclical and turbulent in terms of how many manufacturers there are, how many jobs there are, who's coming to race and when. And actually, off the back of, you know, I was 23, and off the back of giving those performances, I searched the whole marketplace, and there was actually nowhere to go at that point. And you think, right, I've done the job. You know, if you're a cricketer playing England under 21 and you do the job, you know, you can look forward to potentially, you know, a spot, maybe a reserve spot even in the main professional team. There was no main professional team at that point. And that's what was really tough. You know, so you find yourself going snakes and ladders again, all the way back down to square one, and have to do it all again the next year. And it was, that was a really difficult one to swallow. Personally,
a quick interruption to the show to remind you to check out our sponsor, F1 Experiences. F1 Experiences offer a wide range of packages that come direct from Formula One, giving you a unique experience of the pinnacle of motorsport. Official ticket packages come with the very best race tickets, first class hotels and transfers, and unprecedented access, including driver appearances, private pit lane walks, behind the scenes tours of the illustrious F1 paddock, team garages, the famous podium, and loads more. It's the closest you can get to Formula One, and thanks to F1 Experiences, Motormouth listeners can save 5% on your next F1 Experiences package by using the code MOTORMOUTH when booking online at f1experiences.com.
How do you keep yourself motivated with that kind of thing?
I mean, I'd only been going at it for 1 year, and so, you know, you push on. I still had great support from Richard Mille, who came with us to Le Mans the first time, when really sponsored us to do Le Mans, or sponsored me to do Le Mans, but when I was sharing with Dad, and because it was an incredible story, and because, you know, it was a moment for them. But then stayed with me as I continued my racing career, which is one of the things which has, you know, really changed my career and my life. He's a passionate guy, he's a great guy, and he just loves motorsport and has supported me since. And so I had another shot. I had another shot at it, even though at that point, you know, sports cars were starting to ramp up in terms of the young drivers' interest. And it was starting to become a lot more like a kind of a Formula 2, where drivers were coming, bringing big budgets and kind of squeezing others to the side a little bit. So, yeah, I struggled through the end of the year 2013 to actually find a seat at that point, but managed to keep going with Ligier into the next year in Oak Racing.
And next year was a lot of US racing. How did you find that experience, and are there differences between endurance racing in Europe and the US?
So the next year was an interesting one. I cobbled together a deal to do all of the races that the main works driver, a guy called Olivier Pla, who's an ex-Formula 2 guy, you know, very, very, very quick guy. I cobbled together a deal to do all of the races that he couldn't do, plus some stuff in Europe, plus, and in order to pay for that, I did a load of development of the next Ligier sports car, you know, up and down airfields and that kind of thing. America was just, I think it's probably the best sports car racing I've ever done. Very political, very, very political, you know. And we were there in a, you know, funny pink Ligier racing Corvette. So it was not always as straightforward as it might have been, you know. And it was an interest, but it was a really interesting year. It was a really interesting year. I learned a lot about myself. I won a pole award for putting our car on pole and got some great results and some great podiums. Led Le Mans for hours on end with Jan Mardenborough, the game into racer.
Yeah.
And did the whole of that. But again, you know, we got the results, got the pole positions, got to the end of the year and got offered a contract with an invoice attached to it. And I kind of ran out of steam at that point. I broke myself a little bit as well, because I used to fly from, I'd fly from the UK to Charles de Gaulle, then Charles de Gaulle to America, then America to Charles de Gaulle, because the team were handling the flights. I did 25 days development up and down an airfield in between the races as well. And I messed up the muscles in my stomach by being on economy plane, then in the car all day, then economy plane, then in the car all day.
Oh my God.
Then driving between the airports. So that's why I was.
There was an excuse for first class, that's the best one.
wasn't gonna happen at the time.
It's tough, isn't it? It's hard balancing that US racing. Max Chilton did it, didn't he? Still does to a point when he did Indy Lights and then Indy Car. And he was bouncing. He was living in the UK, still is. You know, bounces around from the UK to the US. Does so many flights. Something tells me he doesn't travel economy though. But hey, you know. Your career kept on improving, and as you say, you learn and you learn, and you took, fast forwarding slightly, ELMS 2016 with United Autosports, had a super successful year. Did some WEC rounds in there as well, taking wins. That must have been a great year for you.
Yeah, it was awesome. And the first year, I mean, United Autosports now, in terms of LMP racing, outside the manufacturer teams are it, you know. But their first ever prototype driver was me. And that's quite nice. I mean, Zach Brown and Richard took me off a year where I'd not really done anything, just because I'd been a little bit unwell for a while. And then I carried on through, but basically was ringing around, gave him a ring. And, you know, from that year, from the results that we gained with United Autosports, I managed to get the end of the season with G-Drive, G-Drive Racing, and then just with René Rast and Roman Rusinov, which was a tongue twister of a set of teams to explain. And we just, I mean, it just worked, you know, motorsport giveth and motorsport taketh away. It's just a year that where we just happened to be in the right place at the right time almost every weekend, really kind of kick-started my career kind of back into life again in racing terms, and gave me another opportunity with the DC Racing setup, which was what came after it. But to be winning races again in the European Le Mans Series and heading out to do a pretty much almost full World Endurance Championship campaign was just mega.
Mm. And it's going, well, I suppose your career is really going from strength to strength now, but also so is the World Endurance Championship, actually, because I want to come on to what you're up to, obviously, for this year in a little bit. But just before we touch on that, the hypercars that are coming out.
So cool.
What do you think of them? Because at first glances, they look awesome and they're inspiring a whole wave of manufacturers to join and return to endurance racing, which is an incredible thing.
Yeah, I mean, what they've managed to do is make top class endurance racing work with a with an element of hybrid at a sensible cost for manufacturers. And so that's what the manufacturers asked for, and they've, you know, the ACO have delivered it. And so now, amazing, we've got loads and loads of manufacturers coming into the sport, which has just an awesome trickle-down effect on the whole sport. More manufacturers equals more viewers equals more private teams equals more young drivers wanting to move through the sport. And so, yeah, I mean, Le Mans 2023 is going to be, I believe, one of the greatest sporting events there's ever been. Now, I'm a bit biased, but, you know, I think it's going to be just incredible. You know, Porsche, Ferrari, Audi, Peugeot, all of those teams, Alpine potentially. And I don't think we've seen the last of the manufacturer announcements either. So, and of course, Ferrari. Yeah. So it'll just be
really exciting.
Yeah.
Is it time, Tim?
I think it is time. So there comes a point in every show where we have to pass our guest to Mr. Harry Benjamin to introduce probably the highlight of your career, I would have thought. This is probably going to be up there. So, Harry, over to you to introduce our illustrious quiz.
Yes, Alex Brundle, welcome to Motor Mouths, the hardest quiz in motorsport, because all the answers are based on Wikipedia, so we all know how reliable that is.
I'm going to be terrible at this. Okay.
It's a very competitive leaderboard. There are 14 points up for grabs, but it varies, because if I'm feeling sorry for you, I might just give you an extra point. The bottom of the leaderboard is Karun Chandhok with 3.5 points. The top...
Okay, well... He's the oracle on F1.
Exactly. So that's how you know. The top of the leaderboard is Alexander Sims with 14 points. So, and then there's a whole wave of people in the middle. Some big names in there on some pretty lowly points. Johnny Herbert got 8 and down in 33rd position. So this is the kind of quiz. Are you ready for your first question?
I'm prepared.
Okay. Yes. Alex, we talked about you racing in GP3, but in your first GP3 race, where did you finish?
10th.
Oh, bang.
Oh, he's got it. Spot on. What a strong start. That's 3 points in the bag. You did finish 10th. Well done. Okay, gets harder now. How many F1 teams did your dad race for?
Eight.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, name them.
Oh. Tyrrell Zach Speed.
Yeah.
Jordan. Tyrrell. Jordan Williams. Yep. McLaren.
Yeah.
How many have you got? How's that? Five.
Benetton.
Yeah. Fine. You can have that.
I think there's two. There's two more. You haven't said.
Brabham.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, three. Now two more.
Tyrrell, Zach Speed, Jordan, Williams, McLaren, Benetton, Brabham.
One more, isn't it? One more.
It's one more, yeah.
There's one more.
One more. Can you get it?
One more. Oh,
He's so Googling. Look at him. He's getting
he's
on Googling.
Googling. He's Googling. He's Googling. Oh, no, he's not. He's had that. Okay. I'm going to give you... I'm going to get... Right, you've got 5 seconds to try and get it. 5, 4...
I think we've even named it
2
in our chat so far.
1. Oh, I'm afraid the time's up, Alex. No. But I'm going to give you... You've got... I mean, you've got 7 out of 8, so I'm going to give you 2 points out of 3. It was Ligier.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, disappointing. Cool, disappointing.
That's really rubbish.
Yeah, but I mean, you've already smashed Karun Chandhok out of the park.
I've literally met Guy Ligier, and he went, "I love it when your father used to drive for me."
He's not going to be impressed by this. Right. Question 4. After karting, you stepped into T cars, which we discussed. We want to bring it back. We're on the mission for it. Yep. But what year did T cars cease to exist?
Not long after I did it. Such was my effect. I'm going to say 2008.
Oh, it was 2007.
So close.
So close. Okay, for a bonus point, Who finished last in the 2020 Formula 2 driver's standings?
2020 Formula 2 driver's standings. Who finished last? It wasn't Sean Galale. He was out for the whole year, but he got some points. Was it Giuliano Alesi?
No. Bad luck. It was Teo Pourchaire.
Of course, because he guested two races.
He guested those last two.
That's a curveball.
That's a curveball. But you know, I'm going to go back to the 2007 question, the T-Cars. I'm going to give you 1 point for only being one out.
So I'm getting pity points.
Yes,
you're getting pity points now because you were on such a good streak to begin with and then it just went downhill. But let me do the maths because that is the end of the quiz. One, two, three. Okay, I've done the maths. We're not in double digits. But it's a respectable 9 points, which puts you just above Thierry Neuville, of course, World Rally Star, and just below Freddie Hunt in 29th.
That is a dangerous place to be.
In 29th position. So, Alex Brundle, thank you very much for playing Motormouth.
29!
I mean, the leaderboard goes on for about 50 people.
I wish I had some toys so I could throw them out front.
Anyway, just start smashing shit up. Just grab those Perspex boxes behind you. Now, listen, before we come on to your commentary bits and pieces, let's chat about 2021. So, you've signed with the Polish team, Inter-Europol competition. How has this deal come about? Are you pleased with their choice of livery? Because you're wearing some very funky overalls. Tell us more about this relationship.
Yeah, it's bright stuff. They'll see us coming. So we tried to sign together last year. But they're moving through. It's as a lot of these LMP2 teams are, based around a family who want to race and have a team and a great business, business based in Poland, team now based in Poland. And you know what? They're super excited. They're super committed and calm. And I'm looking forward to the season ahead. Commercial forces again kind of took over with me at United Autosports, as you know, all of this hypercar stuff brings about a load more, another load of Formula 2 drivers who want to come and do LMP2. Yeah. So, but you know, they're really serious about it. They've taken on Rafał Pokora, who engineered the number 8 Toyota for the last 6 or so years, and a great mechanical team, all from Orica HQ.
Yeah.
And they're going at it with me and Renger van der Zander and Kubas Michalski, who's our silver driver.
And isn't Helio Castroneves involved somewhere along the line?
Yeah, so Helio was for Sebring when there was going to be, because Renger is also driving for Ganassi, Chip Ganassi Racing in IMSA. And so Helio was going to jump in for Sebring when Renger was unavailable. However, due to COVID-19, our calendars have moved around a little bit. So now it's going to be Renger throughout the whole year. But we've had Helio in the meetings, and actually, to be honest, he's already contributed to the program because of his experiences, like
amazing
Encyclopedia Britannica. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. can you put any expectations on for this year, or is it just a case of you just got to get out and do the first runs and see where you are?
You know, they know so much about this car now because they've had so much regulation stability that actually it's getting to the point where an Orica is an Orica, and actually we can. Providing we can get the car out on track and get the car delivering as it should be, we're in the position to win races, I think, by the end of the year with the driver lineup we have. Certainly the environment comes with funding, and funding's what you need. Yeah. Once you have funding and you have knowledge and the right people in place, then anything's possible. I'm really looking forward to the year. We're dark horses. Well, we're not dark horses because we're green and yellow, but
green and yellow horses.
In figurative terms, we're dark horses.
Yeah.
Oh, and it'll be exciting to see how you get on for this year, especially just be good to get racing back up and running, won't it, in a more regular capacity. Sure. But you dovetail both sides of the race track. You're behind the wheel and you're also behind the mic. So a bit of commentary last year for you, F2, F3, F1 TV. Talk to us about, you know, getting behind the mic for the very first time. Was there a thought in your head being like, oh God, I'm doing the same thing my dad's doing?
So it's weird because I've actually been doing it for years, but it's just been very, very low key. So okay. I called endurance racing for an organization called Radio Le Mans. When was my first one? Must have been sort of 2013, 2014 time. And I've been on and off. Just after I finished GP3, I did a couple of guest races with Will Buxton in the box as well. So I've actually been sort of burbling in the way in the background, doing a little bit of commentary since then. But obviously then you kind of arrive on the scene, and just like with all of these things, you arrive on the scene and people go, well, what's it like, you know, just starting out with commentary? And you don't know whether to go, great. Or to go, actually, I've been practicing for a long time. Or whether to just go, brilliant. You know, yeah. It was hard for the first three words, but then after that.
Yeah. I'm a natural, what can I say?
Yeah, took to it like a duck to water. But you and Alex have built up a really good rapport and relationship. And as we know, you know, for anyone that is on Twitter, race fans... I say race fans loosely on Twitter, are very picky about commentators and commentary. Have you felt any of that pressure as you've been going through this process?
They are, but actually I've been so pleasantly surprised personally, because what I absolutely expected when I set foot into the commentary box were, you know, just an avalanche of nepotism comments and an avalanche of, oh, I see your dad's got you a job, yeah. Which is, you know, actually broadly not the case in many ways. I work for a totally different company. I work for Formula One. Dad works for Sky, who has no jurisdiction. And even, you know, even in your own business, to walk in for a business you work for and go, employ my son, yeah. If you think about it in real terms, it's not really that feasible.
Yeah.
But I get it. I get that the optics are in that direction. And so, but actually I've really not had that. And people give you a chance. They really do give you a chance. If you mess it up, they tell you, and you have to be very prepared for not everybody to like what you do and to receive criticism in a professional manner. You guys must have a really, you know, a similar thing, or anybody in media does. But I've been so pleasantly surprised by the audience's, you know, desire to give me a shot before they start loading on me too much, which I haven't had. I've had broadly pleasant comments from everybody, which has been lovely.
And I suppose actually it's because, you know, you work for F1, not Sky. It's arguably a smaller but more engaged audience. So people are... I often find that the people who actually make the complaints, the people who are who almost like passerbys, if that makes sense. Do you think that's the case?
Certainly, our audience is, yeah. They're the kind of people where if you didn't exactly say it properly, they know what you mean. As opposed to the people who are like, you're just talking nonsense. What are you? Yeah, but. Yeah, I certainly think as you go to a bigger audience, then tastes vary more. And that's the real challenge of it. And that's when, you know, I think I have certainly still a lot to learn as a broadcaster rather than somebody who analyzes motorsport in that capacity. To be able to talk simultaneously to kind of my audience now, who when I say, you know, the drive shaft is broken and so he won't be getting any more, you know, and so the it's revving all the way through and he won't be making it back to the pits, know what I mean? And also the audience who if you just came out with something like that, you'd have to explain what a drive shaft was, why it was revving all the way through, and why that means he won't make it back to the pits, you know, and it is that group who you really have to bring along with you, I guess.
Yeah. And it must be comforting to have someone like Alex next to you or whoever it is that you're in the commentary box with. I mean, he's obviously a rising star and will go on to huge things. But, you know, as we know, Harry and I, you know, if you take one of us away, the job instantly becomes a little bit more challenging. And, you know, where there's a pause or a gap, you can fill that or someone can fill that. It must be nice to be not learning your trade, because you say you've done it for many years, but developing alongside someone like him?
I mean, him, Jack Nicklaus, they are genius. I don't know how they do it. And I've got no intention to ever color commentate a broadcast of motorsport or any other sport, because you look across the box and it just, the level of information that they process in order for me to just drop in and, you know, analyze a bit of data or drop in a pithy comment.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's a complete career, and it's so far removed from what I do on my side of the box that it's a different sport. You know, people that assume that kind of coming from the technical commentary side of the box and just jumping across into the color side is like the next logical step. I mean, yeah, no way, no chance, you know. It's brilliant to have somebody who is in control of the broadcast, makes you look better. And indeed, if you're somebody who always has something to say, to give them a bit of a break to recapture control of the broadcast, then they really appreciate you as well.
Yeah.
It's such a partnership.
What about that? Obviously, your dad has got some classic moments of walking up and down the starting grid in F1. Have you experienced that side of things? Does that part of it appeal to you?
It does. The period of time where I've actually been covering F1 or F2 has all been COVID related. So actually, I've barely been to the racetrack.
Yeah.
I rely on, we get a massive feed of data in to, we're in Biggin Hill. To avoid any doubts, we're in Kent, and we're sat in a studio. But we get a massive feed of data in, and I work pretty much universally from the data, plus, you know, social media discussions with all of the various drivers I know. Lucky enough to still know a lot of them because they're kind of my contemporaries. I've never done too much of that. It definitely does appeal, and I think there's a certain point where you have to make your presence in the paddock felt and build your contacts to try to, if you're going to go and do that, to try to offer the audience more than they can get by just watching all of the feeds and reading all of the information that comes out of a Formula One weekend.
Yeah.
Mm. Did you, when you first started all those years ago, did your dad give you any tidbits or any bits of advice, or was it just sort of let you get on with it?
Well, I mean, for the stuff I was doing from kind of a little while back, it's been very bitty, you know. It's been kind of like every year or so, you know, Eve at Radio Le Mans would ring me up and go like, do you fancy calling the 6 hours of Fuji? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
We've got nobody else to do it. For this, not so much, but then I would say Jake's, he's been a big help. He knows exactly how he wants the broadcast to run. The team at F1 have been a big help, and then all of your producers. I mean, you're never short of advice.
Yeah.
You're never short of advice on how to do it, because, you know, there are so many experienced people in TV, particularly working in environments like F1 or Sky, that can really help you to grow your understanding. Yes, I do lean on Dad occasionally. I ring him up more for kind of, what do you think is going to happen in this scenario, kind of ideas to direct. More sharing of information, you know. Do you think this driver is going to go to this place, and or do you think this session is going to be stopped because of this? You know, we get in a situation where, you know, I have a lot of data. I'm in the comm box all day. Dad has a lot of on the ground presence. He's in the, you know, he's there all day at the racetrack and can, you know, I send him a text in the middle of this year, is it raining?
Because I'm not there,
and I can't tell on the. So I picked up my iPhone, I opened up iMessage, and I just sent him a voice. Is it right?
Yeah.
And he just sent me one. Yes.
All right,
thank you.
It's funny.
And so then, I just go off air, ask him if it's raining. He tells me it's raining. I go, it's raining in turn four.
Yeah. There's a value in having him as you.
Yeah, it helps.
It's funny though, because you can definitely hear him in you. Like, you know, just chatting to you now, and I'm sure you're very aware of it, you do share a lot of similarities in your voice. You know, that you have your own unique style, of course, but you can, if you didn't know, that he was your dad. After listening to you for an hour or so, you know you can hear it. Let's talk about, quickly about F2. Mick Schumacher coming into F1.
Yeah.
Obviously coming in as champion. How highly do you rate him, and what sort of impact do you think he can have on the sport?
I think he's going to have a positive impact on the sport generally, and I do really rate Mick. He made a couple of errors at the start of the year, but then suddenly just completely got his head together and just became Mr. Consistent all the way through to the end of the year. But he wasn't one of these Mr. Consistents that never shows pace either. You know, delivered in qualifying when he had to, struggled a bit, I would say, slightly in the biggest pressure moment, but had enough ability, had enough skill behind him to recover it, and just didn't fall apart in the final races, which I think is a really telling thing for when you're going to jump into that big stage. You know, earlier on in his career, they really protected him from kind of the limelight, which was an incredibly intelligent thing to do. He moved into Formula 2. He's going to get yet another stage of limelight. Now he moves into Formula 1. And we're going to find out really if he's psychologically prepared for that. He's certainly physically prepared. I mean, he's the fitness of the guy is clear to see. And he certainly has the ability. The only thing that will prevent Mick now from achieving what he wants to in Formula 1 is just the load of pressure which is going to fall on him.
That's a good point, because could you argue that perhaps for this first year, the pressure might be slightly lessened? I'm not going to say off, but because Haas have just come out and said, you know, they're not developing their car past pre-season testing, it's probably not going to be dramatic improvement from last year. And Haas, you know, they could only score a point if, you know, all things went terribly wrong for other people. So do you think, with that in mind, for this first year at least, the pressure is slightly lessened? Or do you think that doesn't matter? He's still got to be on his own game and, you know, he's got to finish 15th as long as his teammate is behind him?
I think the concept that you can ever cruise in F1 is a bit unrealistic. But I think that at the same time, you know, you've always got your teammate across the box. There may well be other teams that get their upgrade tokens or that get the change in the aerodynamic package through into next year ludicrously wrong and end up behind Haas. You know, so to predict the way that it's going to play out is always difficult. People know, and Ferrari will be continually evaluating his performance, of course, in that Haas car. There's always pressure. Yeah, is he fighting at the front? No. Will he have to fight all year? Yes. And certainly on that day, that one day where it's raining sideways and 10 cars have fallen off and Haas might get a chance to get one point, a couple of points, it needs to be him and not Mazepin, or it needs to be him and not someone from another team from his perspective.
Yeah. So in that case, you know, F2 has lost to F1, I suppose. Schumacher, and Ilott's gone off. He's doing some sports car stuff and testing. Tsunoda's moved on, Mazepin. So who's next? Who have you got your eye on?
I've got my eye on Felipe Drugovic. I think he's going to be very strong. Schwartzman stays on again and will be very strong this year. I mean, Prema, ART had a bit of a struggle last year. And I think we'll get their heads together. But, you know, Piastri moving through is going to be an interesting one for his first year in Formula 2. I mean, it's hard to predict, isn't it, how they're going to... Because I can tell you, it's such a different type of car. The driving technique is just worlds apart. You know, you've got a F3 car which is all about U-shape, what we would call U-shape, so taking the minimum speed out of the car with a brake pedal, and then an F2 which is just a completely V car. You get in, you turn the car and you get out because you've got all that power to get you back up to speed. So it's going to be interesting to see how the rookies do. But yeah, I mean, anybody who's won races last year, you know, Felipe, Drugovic or those kind of guys moving through into their second year of Formula 2 racing, it's a must-win scenario.
Do you think another thing to worry about, I suppose, as a driver is obviously the calendar's sort of shifted a bit this year, and there's less and more gaps. Is that there was a big issue coming into Bahrain, wasn't it, actually, last year, because they had so much time off do you think that's going to play even more of an issue this season?
It's going to be strategically very difficult as well, because you're having, you know, two sprint races and a feature with an interesting grid rotation set up between the two sprint races. Drivers have been saying to me, I don't know whether it's better to qualify 10th or first. Should we try to qualify 10th? We're a bit lost strategically in the next phase of Formula 2. And so that can play into it. Yes, certainly, you know, it's something where drivers are also going to have to be quarantining for the first part of the year. It's going to be difficult to get to the races. It's going to be difficult to test. I mean, for example, we've just lost the first Formula 3 test in Barcelona. That's been postponed. Mm. If that then doesn't happen, or in Formula 2, they're not able to get a test, then, you know, all of a sudden the rookies lose the only period of time they have to get up to speed with these cars. So, yeah, it can be a mixed up year for everybody.
Now, we've quickly taken up an hour of your time. It's shot by.
God, so we have, haven't we?
I know, it's nuts. So we're going to move on to, I wanted to get your opinion on Formula One, but we're going to skip through it and come on to a few questions just to get to know you a little better. we've already discovered who your best mate is in racing. You mentioned that earlier in T-Cars. But I want to know what you're absolutely useless at. What are you totally crap at?
What am I absolutely terrible? I can't park.
What?
I cannot park. My family ripped me to pieces.
Can you reverse park? Can you reverse?
What, any kind of parking?
I can't parallel park.
Yeah.
So my dad ripped me to pieces. He said, I've seen you gap traffic like this, you know, and I can't maneuver unless I'm going fast. I just
floor it when you reverse, when you parallel park, just slam your foot on the throttle.
So I have six goes at getting into a garage, let's say.
Has that ever presented any awkward moments in your racing career? Like you're coming
really
into
awkward, yeah.
Parc Fermé and you just start crashing into Marshalls.
Parc Fermé is okay because you can blame it on the lack of luck.
Yeah.
So you can do that. Yeah, there are periods of time. There are times when I've, you know, so you'll be in a minivan. So say you've arrived in wherever.com and your team are with you because you tend to fly together and you're the driver. So you get chucked in the front of the minivan, so you know, take the team to the hotel. You get to the hotel and there's only on-street parking.
Oh.
Disaster.
Nightmare. So you get to a point, yeah.
Well, in that case, we found out what you're awful at. And then obviously, aside from, you know, racing and broadcasting, what are you brilliant at? Do you have like a hidden talent that we might not know about?
I can play the drums.
Oh. Yeah,
I wouldn't claim to be brilliant at it. I was going to drama school, which my previous engineers won't find surprising at all, but I was going.
No way.
Yeah. I genuinely considered that. While I was at school, I did all the preliminary qualifications for Lambda, and that kind of thing. So I did a lot of that, like kind of studio performances on stage. And
well, Alex, I hate to trump you here, but you are speaking to somebody who trained at RADA.
I was waiting. I nearly said, come on, Harry, get it over and done with. itching to say you went to RADA, aren't you?
You don't get that often on a... You can't say that on a motorsport podcast very often. No. So those two worlds very rarely collide. Well, that's fascinating. Well, I'll tell you that. Yeah, we'll take the acting, drumming. We like the creative sides. Tim, you love this next one though, don't you?
I do, and I'm not going to give you any kind of intro to it. I'm just going to ask it and see where it lands. Feathers or scales, what would you rather?
Feathers.
For what reason?
Because it presents opportunity. Because correctly arranged, you might be able to fly.
Yes,
whereas scales don't give you any incremental opportunity.
You could be a very fast swimmer. Do scales help you go faster?
You could be.
I don't know. I like the way that you've specified if the feathers were arranged properly.
So there's a bit of effort required from you, but yeah. all good things need that.
That's,
you know, so I'm prepared to get you in the middle. Basically, okay. Is what I'm saying.
I that's a very good answer. I like that.
Hell of an opportunity. Alex, look, we've taken up far too much of your time. We end all of our shows with our final three questions, which we ask to every single guest. And we just like to do a direct comparison, really. So, Tim, do you want to kick off?
Sure. What's got you excited at this very moment in time?
I'm about to have lunch.
Oh, what are you having?
So that's, I don't know. That's why I'm excited. Oh. The possibilities are endless.
I'm going to go baked beans on toast for what it's worth, which I'm a big fan of.
Great shout.
Yeah, but I
hate beans.
What are you talking about? You hate beans. Everyone loves beans.
Alex, how much of your success is down to luck and right place, right time? And then how much is down to sheer hard work?
Yeah, you're perceiving that I'm successful there, which is very kind of you.
You're on the Motormouth podcast. We wouldn't be calling you otherwise.
90% luck, 10% effort.
It's very modest of you. Yeah. Final question for you. What are you scared of?
I'm afraid of falling off the balcony of my flat.
Is it quite a large drop?
It's a reasonable drop. And I genuinely consider it sat there. And I don't know why, because I'm never going to jump off the balcony of my flat. And there's nothing out there to trip over. But it has a glass front, so you can see the potential.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
If you ever get into any kind of brawl.
Exactly. There'll be no, it's an argument-free zone. There's no brawling on the balcony. Sure.
No brawling on the balcony. I think you need a sign for that just outside.
Definitely,
yeah.
Definitely.
Well, look, Alex Brundle, thank you so much for coming on to the Motormouth podcast. It's been great to chat to you about your career, what's up next for you in endurance racing, and of course, your thoughts on Formula 2, Formula 1, Formula 3. We hopefully will see you doing some more commentary this year as well, whenever that gets back up and running alongside your racing as well. Alex Brundle, thank you so much for coming on to the Motormouth podcast.
Thanks, guys. Great to chat to you.
Before you go, one final reminder to check out F1 Experiences, the official experience, hospitality and travel program of Formula One. F1 Experiences is the closest you can get to the sport. Official ticket packages, which include the best race tickets, first-class hotels, travel and exclusive behind-the-scenes access across a Grand Prix weekend. F1 Experiences offer packages like no other. So to book your F1 Experiences package today, head online to f1experiences.com. And if you enter code Motormouth, you'll get 5% off too. Now, if you're a really lovely person and fancy supporting the podcast further, just head over to Patreon or the link is in the podcast description. We've got some great goodies and bonus content to give you if you sign up. Just search Motormouth Official on Patreon and there are 3 levels of membership to choose from. Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth_, Instagram at Motormouth_official, and Facebook just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review, and until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is chisme ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.